Hi, I'm Catherine Marr, President and CEO of NPR. A big thank you to our listeners and supporters. Your generosity keeps WSHU strong, especially as we cover critical events like the upcoming election. Because of your support, we can provide the trusted, in-depth election coverage you rely on. Your contributions ensure that WSHU remains your go-to source for reliable, thoughtful reporting. Thank you for being an essential part of our community and for making all this possible.
You're listening to After All Things, WSHU's daily news and culture update from the Long Island Sound region. Water quality in the Long Island Sound is improving. Clean water advocates in New York are celebrating an announcement from the White House. Candidates running to represent Connecticut's 5th congressional district debated last night. Three Connecticut cities will get millions in federal funding to remove lead from houses. And one of Connecticut's state parks is celebrating its 100th birthday. Those stories and more are ahead. I'm Molly Ingram, in for Sabrina Garone. Water quality in the Long Island Sound is improving, according to scientists with environmental advocacy group Save the Sound. They released their Long Island Sound report card today. Peter Lindroth is the director of water quality at Save the Sound.
Over 98% of open Long Island Sound water is earning a grade of B or higher. These positive changes reflect the impact of ongoing efforts to reduce nitrogen pollution, the key factor in harmful algal blooms, and low oxygen levels that can damage marine life.
Save the Sound graded more than 50 bays and water basins of open water. Three bays in Connecticut and Long Island got F grades: the Inner Bridgeport Harbor, the Inner Norwalk Harbor, and the Inner Manhasset Bay. Democratic Congresswoman Johanna Hayes of Connecticut and her Republican challenger George Logan met in their only debate in the race for the state's 5th congressional district on Wednesday. WSHU's Ebong Udama was a panelist at the debate and has this report.
One of the many contentious issues in the debate was Donald Trump. When Logan was asked if he supports his party's presidential ticket, he wouldn't mention the former president's name.
I will be supporting the presidential ticket this election.
You can't say the name.
The Republican presidential ticket this election.
That prompted this response from Hayes.
If you are that supportive of your presidential nominee, say it with your chest. You're going to support Donald Trump. You're going to vote for Donald Trump, and people know what that means.
The candidates also clashed over their political records. Logan accused Hayes of being in lockstep with Democratic leadership in Washington and failing to deliver for her constituents.
My opponent's going to continue to tell you over and over again that she's doing a good job, that things are good, they're not as bad as they are. You see it with your own eyes, right? So all of the fancy talk that she can say, look at the results. She hasn't delivered.
Hayes pushed back. She said Logan lacked accomplishment when he served in the state Senate for 4 years and wouldn't be independent if he were elected to Congress.
Mr. Logan talks about bipartisanship, but he wants to go to Congress, and I'll use his word, to be a rubber stamp for the Trump administration, for a Mike Johnson, who would have the gavel and all of the things that we're talking about right now. We wouldn't even vote on those things.
The two also discussed abortion, crime, the southern border, and immigration policy. The debate was briefly interrupted by a pro-Palestinian protester when the topic of U.S. policy in the Middle East came up. Ebong Udama, WSHU News.
Clean water advocates are celebrating the White House's announcement this week that requires public drinking water systems to identify and replace lead water pipes within 10 years. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says the rule also requires more rigorous testing of drinking water and a lower threshold for communities to take action on lead exposure. Rob Hayes is with Environmental Advocates NY. He says the announcement will dramatically improve drinking water quality.
There have been 500,000 lead service lines in New York contaminating drinking water every single day, poisoning generations of children. And finally, thanks to the Biden administration, that is about to end in the next 10 years or so.
The Suffolk County Water Authority has said very few homes have lead pipes. That's because they were built after World War II using copper pipes. Municipalities must submit an inventory of lead service lines to the state by October 16th.
Local support comes from Hartford Healthcare, the only health system in the Northeast, with all its hospitals receiving A grades for safety from the Leapfrog Group, the nation's leading independent safety watchdog group. HartfordHealthcare.org.
Sleeping Giant State Park is one of Connecticut's most beloved hiking destinations. The mountain itself is about 210 million years old, but October 12th marks the 100th anniversary of its designation as a state park. WSHU's Sabrina Garone spoke with Trina Mace Learned of the Sleeping Giant Park Association and New Haven Museum.
I understand that photography is what sparked this love and passion for Sleeping Giant State Park for you. Could you tell me a little bit about that? And what about the park do you find so inspiring?
I was working on a graduate degree at Wesleyan University and took a pandemic perfect course called Photographing Connecticut State Parks. Every person was obligated to choose their own park. I chose Sleeping Giant State Park because I live not far from it in New Haven. When one has the opportunity, first of all, in the pandemic, to get out and hike 5, 6, 10 hours a week, taking thousands and thousands of pictures, one develops a real love for the park. But I'm also an architectural historian. And what was interesting to me on these more extensive hikes was the discovery of abandoned structures at the west end of the park. I had never known that there were structures in the park. I was fascinated as to what their history might be. Where did they come from and why were they there? What had they housed? That began my discovery process of understanding what was at the west end of the park that had created those buildings, which turned out to be a quarry. And it was through the understanding of those buildings and the quarry operation that existed there that I started to unravel the story of the founding of Sleeping Giant State Park. And it turned out to be much more complicated, much more intricate, and therefore much more fascinating than one presumed it might have been. So,
Very cool. Not to go on a tangent so quickly into this, but you know, you mentioned that you could choose any state park for that assignment, and Connecticut is a small state, but I feel like has a really good number of state parks. Do you feel like Connecticut does a good job with this kind of land preservation? I mean, what do you think is the state of the state parks?
That's an interesting question. I think there are, I may have this number not quite right, but I'm in the ballpark, 127 state parks in Connecticut.
Wow.
So they're numerous. Sleeping Giant is by far not the first. It's probably in the 70s or 80s in the order of its of when it was founded. State parks in general are a phenomenon of the early 20th century. So national parks came first in the sense that they were national parks were developed around really significant monuments or some sort, land formations, so forth. And of course, municipal parks were everywhere, a town green, et cetera. Connecticut had almost no state parks. And so in the 20s, when other states were starting to have this movement, there began to be a real push to create state parks in Connecticut so that people had access to all the amenities that could be in a state park. Not too precious to be a national park, and generally of a larger magnitude or size than a municipal park.
And prior to it officially becoming a state park, what did Sleeping Giant look like and what was the land being used for?
Certainly going back to indigenous peoples, the Quinnipiac occupied the land around Sleeping Giant. And prior to that, it was formed by a series of glacial activity and so forth. A Sleeping Giant, because of, obviously, it is known because of the contour, so it can't help but think about it as a human being, as a Sleeping Giant. A little Gulliver's Travels ideas come into mind here. It is the only transverse ridge in that whole volcanic formation. So East and West Rock and New Haven are also part of that formation, but here this goes across. The people who had owned land on Sleeping Giant before it became a state park, there were numerous, maybe as many as 100, certainly 80 or so, of various different size parcels. There had been people who had built cabins on the various ridges, the tops, whether They're called ridges 1, 2, or 3, or 4, but they're also called the belly, the knee, the chin, and so forth. And in fact, the person who owned the head, there was one person who owned the head, was also the person who leased his land to the quarry operation, which took place and took off part of the head. The rest of the landowners were convinced through the urgings of a couple of Yale affiliates, particularly the then dean of the forestry school, who felt that this was the ideal location for a forest preserve. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily meant to be a park or a state park, but a forest preserve, some place where the integrity of the forest could be viewed and accessed by the people of New Haven. And he and his influential friend at Yale convinced a lot of property owners to actually donate their land toward this effort of creating a forest preserve. Sometimes they bought it. Sometimes they collected money to buy it. It was a very, very early example of a public-private partnership because these were people who did not want the park for themselves. This was not a land grab. There was never any eminent domain exercised. It was completely voluntary. Landowners gave up their land or sold it for a reasonable cost. And as it was collected, a group becoming the Park Association then presented it to the state of Connecticut in hopes that it would become a state park.
That is pretty interesting that landowners would be so willing to do that, I guess, for the greater good. Was there some push and pull there, or was it, no, this is very important and I'm totally on board?
It is fascinating, particularly when we think of it in the context of today. Yes. I suspect that there were a couple of factors that came into play. But it was a tough place, and so I think there was a groundswell that if they were surrendering their land or selling their land for the greater good in a way that they knew that the land would stay as beautiful as they had stewarded it, that there was an impetus to do it. But I think you're right. There was no small amount of influence that happened to entice these people to participate as landowners surrendering their land.
That was WSHU's Sabrina Garone speaking with Trina Mace Learned, who will be leading a presentation on Sleeping Giant history. It's October 30th, 6 p.m. at the New Haven Museum. For the latest news from the Long Island Sound region, listen on the radio, stream on WSHU.org, or download the WSHU app. After All Things is supported by Hartford HealthCare. I'm Molly Ingram, in for Sabrina Garone. Talk to you tomorrow.